Well, today we've reached the end. Actually, we'll see in the coming weeks, it's not really the end. It's just the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end, however you want to put it. But after today, you won't have any more kings that you're going to have to try to remember. There's only one king after the kings of today, and that's the king that reigns forever, Jesus Christ. Today, we're going to finish up on the kings of the southern kingdom of Judah, and we're going to see why that lineage ended, or why that kingship stopped, and what caused that, and where we are there. Now, we'll go back. Last week, we wrapped up and stopped talking about Josiah. Okay, we were talking about Jeremiah, the great prophet, and the last king that we looked at when we were talking in last week's lesson was the king Josiah. So let's kind of pick up from there. Remind ourselves real quickly, what kind of a king was Josiah? You know, we've gone through these kings of the northern and southern kingdom, and we've classified them as good kings and bad kings based on what? Based on their faithfulness to God. So, what about Josiah? Where did he rank? 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 25 says that neither before nor after Josiah was there a king like him who turned to Yahweh as he did, with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his strength in accordance with all the law of Moses. So, what kind of a king was Josiah? He was good. He was not only good, he was the best, it says here. He was the most obedient king. He looked to God in obedience more than any other king of Judah. But you know, if you remember a few weeks back, we said something like that about somebody else, right? Didn't we say that King Hezekiah was the best they ever had? Well, let's go back and look at that. Chapter 18, verse 5 says, Hezekiah trusted in Yahweh, the God of Israel. There was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before him or after him. All right, how can you have both? You've got two kings, Hezekiah and Josiah, and both of them are presented as being the best that Judah ever had, either before them or after them. Well, something's messed up there, right? Well, if you look at the wording that's used in both of those verses, what's stressed there in Hezekiah? It says that he trusted in God. So the picture we get of Hezekiah is being the most faithful, okay, the one who put his trust in God the most. Whereas Josiah, if we look back there, we see that that one focuses on obedience, obeying God's law, obeying the law given by Moses. So Hezekiah was the most faithful, and Josiah was the most obedient to God's law. Nonetheless, these were the two best kings of Israel, of Judah. Okay, we've had some other good ones, but these were the best. They sought the Lord, like David had. All right, what happened to Josiah? 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 29. While Josiah was king, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up to the Euphrates River to help the king of Assyria. Well, why would he go help the king of Assyria? Because there's this other power that's coming into play that's creating a problem for Assyria, and looks like it will threaten Egypt as well. And that is the power of Babylon. And we will see that is the case as time goes on. So he goes up to ally with Assyria. On his way, King Josiah marched out to meet him in battle, but Necho faced him and killed him at Megiddo. So what happened to Josiah? He died in battle against Pharaoh Necho at Megiddo. Now, were the Egyptians coming to fight the Jews? No. They were going to fight the Babylonians. Why did God allow this to happen? Why did God allow Josiah to be killed? Why wasn't God on Josiah's side? Turn back to 2 Chronicles 35. This is the same account in Chronicles, starting verse 21. I get a little bit more detail here. We see that, I'll start at verse 20. Necho, king of Egypt, went up to fight at Carchemish on the Euphrates, and Josiah marched out to meet him in battle. But Necho sent messengers to him, saying, "What quarrel is there between you and me, O king of Judah? It's not you I'm attacking at this time, but the house with which I'm at war. God has told me to hurry, so stop opposing God who's with me, or he will destroy you." Josiah, however, would not turn away from him, so he disguised himself to engage him in battle. He would not listen to what Necho had said at God's command, but went to fight him on the plain of Megiddo. So even though God had warned and had tried to warn Josiah not to do this, Josiah had not turned to God and inquired of God, as we saw was so important for God's people, is to inquire of God to find God's direction, but rather this was out of his pride. Okay, out of his pride. Oh, God's with me. And he took it upon himself to go fight Egypt. And God even warned him through Pharaoh Necho, through the pagan Pharaoh of Egypt, that Judah was to be uninvolved here. But nonetheless, he attacked and he lost his life then. Okay, so what happened after that? Who succeeded Josiah and what happened to him? Back to 2 Kings. We're bouncing. And we're not only going to bounce between 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, but also into Jeremiah. And then, as we go on, we'll get into Lamentations and then especially into Ezekiel. We'll cover a lot in Ezekiel today. So, 2 Kings chapter 23, first part of 31, we see that Jehoahaz, who was the son, we see in the previous verse, Jehoahaz was the son of Josiah, and he was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem only 23 months. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, just as his fathers had done. Pharaoh Necho put him in chains at Riblah in the land of Hamath, so that he might not reign in Jerusalem, and he imposed on Judah a levy of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. So Josiah, when he died, his son Jehoahaz, who was 23 years old at the time, took over, and he did not turn his face towards God as his father Josiah had done. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So as a result, he didn't last very long. Okay, within 3 months, God allowed Pharaoh Necho to take him and take him back to Egypt, and his kingship ceased. Okay, now let's go to Jeremiah, because these last few kings, Jeremiah was there during their time. You know, we saw at the beginning of Jeremiah in chapter 1, verse 2, it says that Jeremiah, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah during the reign of Josiah, starting in Josiah, and through the reign of Jehoiakim, and down to the reign of Zedekiah. And basically, everybody we're going to talk about now, today, from Josiah on, Jeremiah was there during those kingships. Okay? And we'll see that Jeremiah gives prophecies before their kingships about what's going to happen to them. And so what prophecy did God give through Jeremiah about Jehoahaz? Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 11. This is what the Lord says about Shallum, son of Josiah. Well, who's Shallum? Well, Shallum is Jehoahaz. It's the same. Shallum was his given name, but Jehoahaz was his throne name. People would often take throne names. Jehoahaz means Yahweh seizes. Okay, that's just what the word, what the name means. So going on, this is what Yahweh says about Shallum, the son of Josiah, who succeeded his father as king of Judah, but has gone from this place. He will never return. So this is after he's been taken to Egypt, and Jeremiah prophesies that he will never return. He will die in the place where they've led him captive. He will not see this land again. Okay. So he was seized by Necho and taken to Egypt, and Jeremiah prophesied that he would never return again. All right, then, who succeeded him? Back to 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 34. Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim the son of Josiah. So this is Shallum, or Jehoahaz's brother. And his name is Eliakim, son of Josiah, king in place of his father Josiah. And he changed Eliakim's name to Jehoiakim. Now, what does it mean when someone changes someone's name or someone gives somebody a name? Well, that's a sign of ownership. That's a sign of control. That's a sign. If I can give you a name, then that means I've got some control over you. And so by changing his name, Pharaoh Necho showed that he was in charge. Now, you see how he changes his name. It's really not much of a change. He changes from Eliakim to Jehoiakim, which, if you remember some of the language lessons we've had, El means God, and Yah, or Jah, or Jeho, means Jehovah, or Yahweh, okay? And so he changed it from God has established, is what Eliakim means, God has established, and Jehoiakim means Yahweh has established, okay? Okay, so it's not much of a name change, but it's symbolic of saying that Pharaoh Necho was in charge. So Pharaoh Necho took Jehoahaz and carried him off to Egypt, and there he died. Jehoiakim paid Pharaoh Necho the silver and gold he demanded. In order to do so, he taxed the land and exacted the silver and gold from the people of the land according to their assessments. Judah was now subject to Egypt, and Jehoiakim, to keep Pharaoh Necho happy, paid protection money, paid tribute, okay, on a regular basis. All right, how faithful was Jehoiakim? And what happened as the story went on? Verse 37, he did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, just as his fathers had done. During Jehoiakim's reign, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, invaded the land, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. Okay, so Babylon conquered Egypt, and now the vassal of Egypt, Judah, now became subject to Babylon. But then, and this is for 3 years, but then Jehoiakim changed his mind and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon. Not a smart thing to do. So we see he was evil in the eyes of Yahweh, not faithful. In fact, I'll give you a hint. None of them are anymore, okay? Josiah was the last good one. So Judah was subject to Babylon for 3 years, then Jehoiakim revolted. How did Babylon respond to that? How would you expect him to? Turn to 2 Chronicles 36, verse 6. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, attacked him, and he bound Jehoiakim with bronze shackles to take him to Babylon. His brother, Jehoahaz, had been taken by Pharaoh Necho to Egypt. Now Jehoiakim is taken by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. Also, verse 7, Nebuchadnezzar also took to Babylon articles from the temple of Yahweh and put them in the temple there. So he captured Jehoiakim, took the temple items and Jehoiakim to Babylon. Now, as we mentioned before, let's go back and see what did Jeremiah prophesy about him, about Jehoiakim. Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 18. Therefore, this is what the Lord says about Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah. They will not mourn for him. Alas, my brother, alas, my sister, they will not mourn for him. Alas, my master, alas, his splendor. He will have the burial of a donkey, dragged away and thrown outside the gates of Jerusalem. So nobody would mourn for him. Nobody, he was no loss, okay? So that was a prophecy of Jeremiah, of God, through Jeremiah. All right, who came after Jehoiakim? Okay, you may be having trouble thinking straight between Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim. Well, let's make it even tougher. Okay, who followed Jehoiakim? 2 Chronicles 36, verse 9. Jehoiachin was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months and 10 days, and he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So Jehoiakim had a son, Jehoiachin, and he was evil like his father. Now, they do sound very similar. Okay, remember, Jehoiakim had been Eliakim. We don't know if Jehoiachin was his name or whether that was given. This is the only name we have for this guy. But it means, just as Jehoiakim means Yahweh will establish, now this says, Jehoiachin says Yahweh establishes. So very similar names. So he was evil like his father. Didn't reign very long. Why not? Verse 10. In the spring, King Nebuchadnezzar sent for him and brought him to Babylon together with articles of value from the temple of the Lord. And he made Jehoiachin's uncle Zedekiah the king over Judah and Jerusalem. Well, who would be Zedekiah? He is his uncle, meaning he is Jehoiakim's brother, meaning Zedekiah is one of the sons of Josiah. Okay, so we're still dealing with the same family. You've had Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and now Zedekiah, all sons of Josiah who have become king. Let's look at the Jeremiah prophecy about Jehoiachin. Jeremiah 22, verse 26. I will hurl you and the mother who gave you birth into another country where neither of you was born, and there you both will die. You will never come back to the land you long to return to. This is what the Lord says. Record this man as if childless, a man who will not prosper in his lifetime. For none of his offspring will prosper. None will sit on the throne of David or rule any more in Jerusalem. He would never come back. He was taken to Babylon and would never come back. None of his offspring would sit on the throne of Judah. And sure enough, that was the case. Well, what happened to Jehoiachin later in Babylon? This is just kind of interesting. Really, the very end of 2 Kings here. Verse 27, in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, in the year Evil-Merodach became king of Babylon, he released Jehoiachin from prison on the 27th day of the 12th month. He spoke kindly to him and gave him a seat of honor higher than those of the other kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiachin put aside his prison clothes and for the rest of his life ate regularly at the king's table. Day by day, the king gave Jehoiachin a regular allowance as long as he lived. So we see that he never did return to Jerusalem, to Judah. But we see that his life got better later on after Nebuchadnezzar was gone, after Evil-Merodach became the king. And we see that he kind of reversed some of the stuff that his predecessors had done and released a number of political prisoners. But you see, he had a good relationship with Jehoiachin here. All right, next guy was Zedekiah, we've seen. Who was Zedekiah? We've already said he was Josiah's son, but a little bit more about him. 2 Kings 24, verse 17. Nebuchadnezzar made Mattaniah, Jehoiachin's uncle, king in his place, and changed his name to Zedekiah. So Zedekiah was not his original name. Mattaniah was. But Zedekiah is the name that Nebuchadnezzar gave him, again symbolizing ownership. And Zedekiah means righteousness of Yahweh. So it's interesting that these pagan kings are giving names to these people, talking positively about Yahweh. And part of the reason for this, you see, is wanting to please that God and not get that God upset. And by tying that person's name to their God would keep them faithful not only to God but to their king, Nebuchadnezzar. So you see he's done that here with this guy, with Zedekiah. Zedekiah made a couple big mistakes, as you have seen so far. These other kings have too. Chapter 36 of 2 Chronicles, starting at verse 12. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh his God and did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet who spoke the word of Yahweh. He also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar. By the way, let me stop there and mention, if you go back and look at the stories in Jeremiah, you see that Zedekiah, he was real wishy-washy. He would call for and talk to Jeremiah and ask for God's direction, but then he wouldn't follow it. When the princes didn't like what Jeremiah was saying, because Jeremiah went around saying, hey, this is God's punishment. The Babylonians coming upon us is what God has prescribed as punishment, so we just need to accept it, and we need to serve the Babylonians. And the princes didn't like that, and they wanted to kill him, and so he allowed them to take charge, and they threw him in prison, and eventually he kind of got them out, but let them get back in. It's just he really was not one to take charge. And you see here the conclusion that the writer of Chronicles says is that he did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet. Okay. All right, going on. He also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, come on. Now, that's already been done, and you're doing it again. Your brother did this, and you saw what that did. And King Nebuchadnezzar had made him take an oath in God's name. So by rebelling against Nebuchadnezzar, he was breaking his oath to Yahweh, his oath to God. Big mistake. Two big mistakes there. He became stiff-necked and hardened his heart and would not turn to Yahweh, the God of Israel. So big mistakes from Zedekiah. We'll kind of pick up from here in a couple of pages. So, but let's kind of take a look at some of the stuff that's going on in the meantime here. With Jeremiah, we looked at Jeremiah last week, and there's a whole lot more to look at. And in fact, we'll look at a little bit more today, but there's still a whole lot more that we're not going to be able to touch on because there's just a lot there. So I recommend you to to go through a study of Jeremiah sometimes, some interesting stories. Well, this situation where Jeremiah came during Josiah, this great King Josiah, but then Josiah's sons and grandson departed from God, and then God was bringing about this destruction. How did God explain all of this to Jeremiah? How did God explain Israel's actions and Judah's actions to Jeremiah? That, you know, why are they rejecting God even though they were faithful to God during Josiah? Well, Jeremiah chapter 3, we looked at this briefly last week, starting at verse 6. During the reign of King Josiah, Yahweh said to me, "Have you seen what faithless Israel has done? She's gone up on every high hill and under every spreading tree and has committed adultery there. I thought that after she'd done all this, she would return to me, but she did not. And her unfaithful sister Judah saw it. So I gave faithless Israel her certificate of divorce." That is, when he brought the Assyrians in to destroy Israel. That's her certificate of divorce. "And I sent her away because of all her adulteries. Yet I saw that her unfaithful sister Judah had no fear. She also went out and committed adultery." So we have the story of God being married to his bride, Israel. And Israel committed adultery by serving other gods and worshiping other gods and not and rejecting Yahweh. And so he gave her their certificate of divorce, the Assyrian exile. Judah saw all this, but yet she continued in Israel's ways. She did not reform herself, even though she had all this warning. Even though God had sent Isaiah to warn Judah that don't act like Israel or else the same thing will happen to you. So these nations have set their own destiny here, right? They've rejected God. And so God's decided, okay, I've given Israel a certificate of divorce. I'll give Judah one as well, right? Because she's continuing to reject me just as her sister. So why should they even listen to Jeremiah? Why should they listen to these other prophets? Back in Israel's time, why should they listen to the prophets at that time? You know, if God had already decided to punish them and to give them a certificate of divorce, should they expect to be welcomed back by God if they return to him? First verse of that chapter. "If a man divorces his wife and she leaves him and marries another man, should he return to her again? Wouldn't the land be completely defiled? But you have lived as a prostitute with many lovers. Would you now return to me, declares the Lord?" So the concept of taking back a straying spouse, just taking back a one who has completely adulterated themselves with many lovers, it says here, is beyond conceivability. It's inconceivable. It's beyond what you could expect. Okay. So, what about God? Verse 12. "Go, Jeremiah, proclaim this message toward the north. Return, faithless Israel, declares the Lord. I will frown on you no longer, for I'm merciful, declares Yahweh. I will not be angry forever. Only acknowledge your guilt. You've rebelled against Yahweh your God. You've scattered your favors to foreign gods under every spreading tree and have not obeyed me, declares the Lord." So, could they return? Yes, God was calling them back. Even though they had played the harlot and completely rejected God, He wanted them back. Okay, he kept calling them back down to the bitter end. How did God try to get his people to come back? Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 4. Jeremiah speaks here. "And though Yahweh has sent all of his servants, the prophets, to you again and again, you have not listened or paid any attention. They said, 'Turn now, each of you, from your evil ways and your evil practices, and you can stay in the land that the Lord gave you and your fathers forever and ever. Do not follow other gods to serve and worship them. Do not provoke me to anger with what your hands have made. Then I will not harm you.' But you did not listen to me, declares Yahweh, and you have provoked me with what your hands have made, and you have brought harm to yourselves." So God sent prophets to him to call him back to him. Out of his love, he sent prophets to try to bring him back. Not just once, but again And again, and again, and again, over and over and over again. You've heard, you may have heard the phrase that God's a God of second chances. Well, God's a God of many chances. He kept trying to call them back, and they kept rejecting him. They wouldn't listen. Why not? Why did God's people reject him so much? Why didn't they, when the prophets came, why didn't they feel that it was necessary to return to God? Micah, the minor prophet that was there around Isaiah's time, kind of summarizes it briefly in chapter 3, second half of verse 11. It says, they lean upon Yahweh and say, oh, isn't Yahweh among us? No disaster can come upon us. So they thought, oh, God's on our side. God's with us. So he's not going to let anything bad happen to us. So that's why they felt comfortable that they didn't have to return. Okay. So what did God decide to do as a result of Israel's continued faithlessness? Jeremiah 25, verse 8. Therefore, Yahweh Almighty says this, because you have not listened to my words, I will summon all the peoples of the north and my servant Nebuchadnezzar. You catch that? God's servant Nebuchadnezzar, this very pagan person, very pagan place of Babylon, but yet God is using him in his servant service. And my servant Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, declares the Lord, and I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants, against all the surrounding nations. I will completely destroy them and make them an object of horror and scorn and an everlasting ruin. I will banish from them the sounds of joy and gladness, the voices of bride and bridegroom, the sound of millstones and the light of the lamp. This whole country will become a desolate wasteland, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. So what was God going to do? He was going to summon his servant Nebuchadnezzar to come and destroy Judah, destroy Jerusalem, banish these people to Babylon. And they would serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. They'd have an exile for 70 years. You notice that God in his mercy and love gives them a timetable. Tells them how long it's going to be. Tells them 70 years. And we'll see in a couple weeks how that panned out, or in a few weeks. So, how would these 70 years of captivity be ended? Verse 12. But when the 70 years are fulfilled, I will punish the king of Babylon and his nation, the land of the Babylonians, for their guilt, declares the Lord, and I will make it desolate forever. So Babylon would be destroyed. They would get their punishment at that time. Right now, Babylon is being used as God's servant to bring judgment on Israel. But later on, Babylon would receive its judgment. And God is telling Judah that. Well, what did God do to begin to bring about this destruction? Go back to 2 Kings here, chapter 24, verse 10. At that time, the officers of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, advanced on Jerusalem and laid siege to it. So they laid siege. They surrounded the city, and no one could go in, no one could go out, which what that means is, whatever food and water's in there is all you got. Once that's gone, then that's gone. And this was a common practice in those days. Armies would surround cities and lay siege to them and wait them out. And after a point, things would get so unbearable in the city that they would surrender, or they would be too weakened to be able to withstand an attack. And that's what we have here. So they came and laid siege to it, and even Nebuchadnezzar himself came up to the city while his officers were besieging it. Jehoiachin, king of Judah, his mother, his attendants, his nobles, and his officials all surrendered to him. Okay? So we see Nebuchadnezzar coming and Jehoiachin surrendering to them towards the beginning of this siege. Jehoiachin was then taken into Babylon. And did Nebuchadnezzar take anything else to Babylon with this first exile? This is what we call the first exile. There's a couple of exiles, a couple of deportations, where people, the Jews were taken. So here we're looking at the first one. So, verse 13. In the eighth year of the reign of the king of Babylon, he took Jehoiachin prisoner. As the Lord had declared, Nebuchadnezzar removed all the treasuries from the temple of the Lord and from the royal palace, and took away all the gold articles that Solomon, king of Israel, had made for the temple of the Lord. He carried into exile all of Jerusalem, all the officers and fighting men, and all the craftsmen and artisans, a total of 10,000. Only the poorest people of the land were left. Nebuchadnezzar took Jehoiachin captive to Babylon. He also took from Jerusalem to Babylon the king's mother, his wives, his officials, and the leading men of the land. The king of Babylon also deported to Babylon the entire force of 7,000 fighting men, strong and fit for war, and 1,000 craftsmen and artisans. So anything and anybody of value Nebuchadnezzar took to Babylon with him at this time. So nothing was left of any speakable value, nobody of any speakable value. It says only the poorest people of the land were left. Now he did in verse 17, which we read before, he then took Jehoiachin's uncle, Mattaniah, and made him king and changed his name to Zedekiah. So there we have Zedekiah. So Zedekiah becomes king of not much, okay? All the smart people, all the good people, all the wealthy and the nobles, anything of value were taken. Okay, they were all taken away. How do you think he felt? How do you think the people felt? Whether the people who were in the exile being taken to Babylon or the few people who were left. Well, one of the people who was left was a guy named Jeremiah. Remember, he's there all throughout. He's there during the reign of Zedekiah. He's also there beyond there, and we'll see that today. So, Jeremiah wrote two books. He wrote the book of Jeremiah, and he also wrote another book called Lamentations, which is a book of lamentations, a book of laments, a book of cries, a book of weeping for what's going on here at this time. So, how do they respond? Lamentations chapter 1. How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. It's empty. You know, it was full of people, but now it's empty. How like a widow is she, who once was great among the nations. She who was queen among the provinces has now become a slave. Bitterly she weeps at night. Tears are upon her cheeks. Among all her lovers, there's none to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. Then zoom down to verse 6. All the splendor has departed from the daughter of Zion. Her princes are like deer that find no pasture. In weakness, they have fled before the pursuer. What's this a picture of? It's a picture of devastation. These people are devastated. They are very upset. They didn't think this could happen to them. There's another key person that's involved here. We have Jeremiah, who's the prophet that stays there in Jerusalem. But there's another guy who then God calls while he's in Babylon. That's another guy who's taken in this exile. And then in Babylon, God calls him to be a prophet. And we see that is Ezekiel. Chapter 1, verse 2. On the fifth month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin, the word of Yahweh came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Kibar River in the land of the Babylonians. There the hand of Yahweh was upon him. So Ezekiel began prophesying while he was in exile, 5 years after the exile. So after 5 years, they've been there, and this guy was just sitting by this river, which is really more of a canal that feeds into the Euphrates, and the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God, it says in verse 1. And God called him to be a prophet. Again, how good of a job is that of a prophet? It's not great. Prophets usually have messages from God that people don't want to hear. Why would God send a prophet now? These people they're receiving their punishment. Why would God send a prophet? You know, what's the purpose of a prophet? A prophet was to call people back to God. Why would God do that? Why would Ezekiel warn the Jews even though they were already receiving God's punishment? Turn to chapter 33 of Ezekiel, starting at verse 7. God tells Ezekiel, "Son of man, I've made you a watchman for the house of Israel. So, hear the word that I speak and give them warning from me. When I say to the wicked, 'O wicked man, you will surely die,' and if you don't speak out to dissuade him from his ways, well then, that wicked man will die for his sin, but I will hold you accountable for his blood. But if you do warn the wicked man to turn from his ways, and he does not do so,
Well, he'll still die for his sin, but you will have saved yourself. So the destiny of these people, I'm putting in your hands, Ezekiel. You need to warn them. Just because they have been removed from the land and removed from the promised land, the blessings that I had promised to give them and that I had given them for so many years as they continue to reject me, they're receiving their punishment, but I still want them back. They still need to return to me. I'm looking for relationships with these people, and I want them to come back to me. So while they're here in Babylon, you are to talk to them and to bring them back to me. And if you don't, then I'm going to hold you accountable for their sin, for their lives, for their deaths, for their punishment. Okay? But if you do warn them and they decide on their own to ignore you, well, then that's their own problem. Ezekiel comes in at this time. Now, these people who were exiled, they were devastated, as we've seen, as we saw at the beginning of Lamentations. There were three main reasons as they thought through it and as they worked through it, and there's three main things that hit them that God then used Ezekiel to respond to. Okay, one of them we see in Lamentations chapter 5, verse 7. It says, "Our fathers sinned and are no more, and we bear their punishment." So their thought is that the reason that we're being punished is not because we've done anything wrong, but because our fathers did something wrong, and we're receiving the punishment for them. Oh, how would they get a crazy idea like that? Well, turn to Exodus chapter 34, verse 7. The second half of that verse says, "God does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the third and the fourth generation." Right there, the Bible says that God punishes the sins of the fathers to the third and the fourth generation. So if your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather sinned, then you receive the punishment, is what that sounds like, right? Now, there's a little twist on that if you turn back to Exodus chapter 20, verse 5, where God's given the Ten Commandments. And in there it says that, "I am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me." So there you see a little part of it there, that it's of those who hate me. As people hate me, as they continue to hate me, they'll continue to receive the punishment from me. Now, there's a few ways to look at this. One way is to recognize that in those days it was not uncommon, and it was common practice, that multiple generations lived in the same home. And you'd have three and four generations in the same home. And so where it talks about visiting the iniquities of the fathers to the third and the fourth generation, it's talking about the whole household here. Okay, and so the whole household would be that. Now, that still kind of leaves the picture of getting punished for something someone else did. Is that what God's saying here? Well, Jesus talks a little bit about that back in his chapter 23 of Matthew, where he condemns the Pharisees. And let's just kind of look at some of this and you'll get a little picture. He's talking to the Pharisees here. "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You build tombs for the prophets and decorate the graves of the righteous, and you say, 'Oh, if we lived in the days of our forefathers, we wouldn't have taken part with them in the shedding of blood of the prophets.' So you testify against yourselves that you are descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Well, fill up then the measure of the sin of your forefathers, you snakes, you brood of vipers. How will you escape being condemned to hell? Therefore, I'm sending you prophets and wise men and teachers. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town. And so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. I tell you the truth, all of this will come upon this generation." What's he saying here? He's saying that these people were kind of saying the opposite. Well, our forefathers killed the prophets. Our forefathers rejected God. You know, if I'd have been back there then, I wouldn't have done that. I would have listened to the prophets. I wouldn't have killed the prophets. I wouldn't have rejected God. And Jesus says, "Bull, you're just like your forefathers. You follow the evil ways of your forefathers. And in fact, you're not just as evil as them. You're going to be even worse. You're going to kill, and elsewhere he says, you'll kill the righteous one. You'll kill God's anointed, the Messiah. But here he also says, God's going to send other people, and you're going to kill them, and you're going to crucify them, and you'll flog them, and torture them. Okay? So you can't claim that you're not part of this. So what part of this is referring to is following the sins of the fathers on the children is, as evil does, evil follows. And parents who teach their children to sin, parents who teach their children to reject God and to follow their own ways, they'll follow in their parents' footsteps. Okay? Parents who do that, parents who live lives that reject God, that do not follow God's footsteps, their children see that, their children emulate that, their children follow that, and so the sins of the fathers are then carried on to the future generations. And that's what you see some of this here. But at this time, as you saw in the verse in Lamentations chapter 5, they were using it as a cop-out. Oh, we don't deserve this. Our fathers deserve this, and we're receiving their punishment. Well, God, through Ezekiel, wants to clarify that. Okay, he wants to make sure that they understand what the real deal is. Chapter 18 really gets into this. We'll just read a few verses, but you may want to read a bit more. What do you people mean by quoting this proverb about the land of Israel? The fathers eat sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. You get that? The fathers eat sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. So, again, we're receiving the punishment of the fathers is what that's talking about here. As surely as I live, declares the Sovereign Lord, you will no longer quote this proverb in Israel. For every living soul belongs to me, the father as well as the son. Both alike belong to me. It's the soul who sins is the one who will die. Okay, you're not going to die for your parents' sins. You're going to die for your own sins. Okay, the soul who sins is the one who will die. Verse 20, the son will not share the guilt of the father, nor will the father share the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous man will be credited to him, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against him. And you know, as we've walked through the kings of Judah, we've seen that. We've seen faithful kings. We saw the great faithful king Hezekiah and the righteousness that God recognized for him because of his faith. But then what happened to his son, Manasseh? Manasseh did not receive any righteous consideration from God because of the righteousness of his father, Hezekiah. God doesn't have any grandkids. We cannot ride upon the coattails of our fathers and our forefathers. God wants a relationship with each one of us. He says here, every living soul belongs to me, both the father and the son. Father and son don't share guilt. But what about their situation? It looks to me, doesn't it look like they are receiving punishment for what their forefathers did? You know, we've got hundreds of years of them rejecting God. You know, why is God saying that they're not being punished for the continued unfaithfulness of past generations? Verse 21. God says, if a wicked man turns away from all the sins that he's committed and keeps all my decrees and does what is just and right, he will surely live. He will not die. None of the offenses he's committed will be remembered against him. Because of the righteous things he's done, he will live. Do I take any pleasure in the death of the wicked, declares the Sovereign Lord? No, rather, am I not pleased when they turn from their ways and live? But if a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits sin and does the same detestable things a wicked man does, will he live? None of the righteous things that he's done will be remembered. Because of the unfaithfulness he is guilty of, and because of the sins he's committed, he will die. So, stop using your forefathers as a cop-out. Stop blaming it on them. If you want to be recognized as being righteous in my eyes, and you want to live, and you want to receive the blessings I've given you, the same promises that I've given the people who have preceded you, I give to you. Turn from your wicked ways. Turn to righteousness with me, turn to a relationship with me, and I will bless you. You will live. But even if you are righteous now, even if you have that relationship with me now, if you turn from your ways and reject me, then I will reject you and I will punish you just as I'm punishing these people now. Okay? So, that's the first thing that God spoke against in Ezekiel is God is punishing us for the sins of our fathers. So they're trying to pass the blame. Alright, the next thing that he spoke against deals with their guilt. We see in chapter 1 of Lamentations, verse 8, Jerusalem has sinned greatly, and so has become unclean. All who honored her despise her because they've seen her nakedness. She herself groans and turns away. Her filthiness clung to her skirts. She didn't consider her future. Her fall was astounding. There was none to comfort her. Look, O Lord, on my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed. So Judah recognizes that she has sinned, that she is dirty, messy with sin. She can't even look at herself. And so there's this pain of guilt. Yes, we have sinned. We are guilty. And this pain of guilt is very heavy. Our guilt is too great. It was a problem. So how does God have Ezekiel respond to this? Chapter 33, verse 10. Son of man, say to the house of Israel, this is what you're saying. Our offenses and sins weigh us down, and we're wasting away because of them. How can we then live? Say to them, as surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that they turn from their ways and live. So turn, turn from your evil ways. Why will you die, O house of Israel? So God has no pleasure in destroying the wicked. He's not about this punishment they're going through is not what he wants either. Rather, he wants them to turn from their wickedness, to turn to him, be faithful, turn from their evil and live. Okay? You may have guilt now, but I'll take that guilt away if you turn back to me. Okay? What was he to say when the Jews would say that God wouldn't be fair and that he would punish them even if they returned? Verse 17. Yet, Ezekiel, your countrymen will say, the way of the Lord is not just. But it's their way that's not just. If a righteous man turns from his righteousness and does evil, he will die for it. And if a wicked man turns away from his wickedness and does what is just and right, he will live by doing so. Yet, O house of Israel, you say the way of the Lord is not just, but I will judge each of you according to his own ways. So again, the same sort of answer. Okay, you've got this guilt, but don't let that get in your way of coming back to me. In fact, let that lead you back to me. Because if you are wicked and you turn and return to me, return to righteousness, I will bring you back to me. Okay, you will live by doing so. All right, the third thing. Lamentations chapter 3. Starting at verse 1, and we'll jump around. The whole chapter kind of talks about it. I am the man who has seen affliction by the rod of his wrath. He's driven me away and made me walk in darkness rather than light. Indeed, he has turned his hand against me again and again all day long. So you get this picture that God has punished them. So they're God is beating us over and over and over again. Okay, and it goes on and talks about that. Then verse 7. He has walled me in so that I cannot escape. He's weighed me down with chains. Even when I call out or cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. He's barred my way with blocks of stone. He's made my path crooked. So he's beaten us, and he's abandoned us, and he's rejected us. He's abandoned us. He won't answer our prayers. He won't listen to us. He won't let us come back to him. That's what it's saying here. And then verse 18. So I say, my splendor is gone. And all that I had hoped from the Lord. So my hope is gone. So their thought is, okay, God's punished us for the sins of the Father, and Ezekiel has clarified that. Our guilt is too great, and Ezekiel has clarified that. Now they're saying, well, God has abandoned us and rejected us, and we have no hope. There's no hope left. Okay? So God gives an object lesson to Ezekiel. This is one you've heard before. You could even sing about it, maybe. Chapter 37, starting at verse 1. And we won't read the whole story, but we'll read key parts of it. The hand of Yahweh was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of Yahweh and set me in the middle of a valley. This valley was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them. So not a real pleasant place to be. And I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. Okay, what does it mean when bones are very dry? Well, there's nothing on them. Everything is gone. It's just bones is all that's left. There's no flesh, no muscle, no anything. So he asked me, "Son of man, can these bones live?" I said, "Well, I don't think so, but O sovereign Lord, you alone know." Well, then he said to me, "Prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord." And then jumping on to the conclusion, verse 10, "So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them, and they came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army." So God had these hopeless, dry bones. There's no hope for them. There's no way anything could happen to these bones other than just they continue to decay. And God had Ezekiel prophesy to them, and they came back to life. So there was hope in this truly hopeless situation, right? So, what did them bones, and dry bones have to do with the Jews' situation? Going on, verse 11. "Then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We're cut off. Therefore, prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Oh, my people, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I am Yahweh when I open your graves and bring you up from them. I will put my spirit in you, and you will live. I will settle you in your land. Then you will know that I, Yahweh, have spoken, and I have done it, declares the Lord." So he says, you think it's hopeless, but it's not. Just as Ezekiel breathed, put my breath into these dry bones and brought life to them, I will bring my spirit and put my spirit in you, and you will live. You will have life. You will have abundance of life. You will live in the land that I place you. So those are messages that God brought to these people through Ezekiel. Okay? Some messages of comfort, some messages that challenged their thinking of why this was happening to them and that they were in a hopeless situation. But no, they were not. God still wanted them to return to Him. God still wanted to have a relationship with them. And so Ezekiel was sent to call them back to that relationship. Alright, well, we left things off with the first deportation under Jehoiachin, and then Zedekiah became king. And then we saw at the end of chapter 24, it says Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Okay, and we already commented that wasn't very smart, but he did. So, going on in the story, in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month. How's that for details? How's that for knowing exactly when this happened? And by the way, this does all agree with archaeological finds they've found in Babylon that talks about this stuff. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with his whole army. He encamped outside the city and built siege works all around it. So we have another siege, just like we had under Jehoiachin. But this is 11 years later. You see back in verse 18 that Zedekiah reigned for 11 years. Well, it's like 9 years later. We'll see in a second. The city was kept under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. Okay, so it's been 11 years here. So it's for a year and a half, Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. By the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine in the city had become so severe that there was no food for the people to eat, nothing to eat. So there was a severe famine. Well, the city was closed up for a year and a half, and they went through all the food stores that were there. How bad did things become? Well, I'll turn to Lamentations chapter 4, verse 10, and very briefly you can see pretty bad. "With their own hands, compassionate women have cooked their own children, who became their food when my people were destroyed." So things were so bad that people ate their own children. Even compassionate women who love their children. It's the only way they could live. In fact, years before, Jeremiah had prophesied that. Look at Jeremiah chapter 19, verse 9 says, I will make them eat the flesh of their sons and daughters, and they will eat one another's flesh during the stress of the siege imposed on them by the enemies who seek their lives. So sure enough, there's another prophecy that was fulfilled here. Well, Zedekiah doesn't want to be captured, so he tries to escape, and what happens? Verse 4, back in 2 Kings 25. Then the city wall was broken through, and the whole army fled at night through the gate between the two walls near the king's garden, though the Babylonians were surrounding the city. They fled toward the Arabah, which is the Jordan Valley, the valley around the Jordan River. But the Babylonian army pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho, which is right there in that valley. All his soldiers were separated from him and scattered, and he was captured. He was taken to the king of Babylon at Riblah, which is up north of Israel, way north, where sentence was pronounced on him. They killed the sons of Zedekiah before his own eyes, and then they put out his eyes, bound him with bronze shackles, and took him to Babylon. So he ran away, but he was caught, and his punishment was that he had to see his sons being killed, and then his eyes were put out. So that was the last sight that he saw. The last thing he saw was his sons dying. And that's what he had to think about all the rest of his life. And he was brought to Babylon and imprisoned there. Well, not only did he take Zedekiah, but he took more. And this is what we call the second deportation, or the second exile. So let's look at that. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 17. He brought up against them, that God brought up against the Jews, the king of the Babylonians, who killed their young men with a sword in the sanctuary, and spared neither young man nor young woman, old man or aged. God handed all of them over to Nebuchadnezzar. He carried off to Babylon all of the articles from the temple of God. So he had taken the wealthy stuff before, but now, and you can see in Jeremiah, it talks about it, he broke up the Bronze Sea, and or actually in 2 Kings chapter 25, all the less valuable stuff. It took everything. Everything was taken. Okay? Both large and small, and the treasures of the Lord's temple and the treasures of the king and his officials. So anything else they took. Then they set fire to God's temple and broke down the wall of Jerusalem. They burned all the palaces and destroyed everything of value there. He then carried into exile to Babylon the remnant, the ones who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and his sons until the kingdom of Persia came to power. So you see that he came and killed many Jews. You see that in that first verse 17 there. But then whoever escaped the sword, everybody else was taken to Babylon. Okay, everyone else was carried off to Babylon. Well, we see Ezekiel hears about this. Now, they didn't have all the news channels and internet and all that back then. So how did he find out about it? Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 21. In the 12th year of our exile, in the 10th month of our 5th day, on the 5th day, a man who had escaped from Jerusalem came to me and said, the city has fallen. So someone came to Babylon. Now, if you're running away from the siege, if you're running away from the attack, if you're escaping, why would you go to Babylon? But he does. Apparently they knew the people there and that were in exile there. So he came and told Ezekiel that the city had fallen. Well, so here we have the second deportation. Now, as you might imagine, with the armies there, some people got away. Some people maybe went and hid in some caves and escaped this exile and escaped the sword. What happened to them? In Ezekiel 33, verse 27. Say to them, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, as surely as I live, those who are left in the ruins will fall by the sword. Those out in the country I will give to the wild animals to be devoured, and those in the strongholds and caves will die of a plague. I will make the land a desolate waste, and her proud strength will come to an end, and the mountains of Israel will become desolate, so that no one will cross them. And then they will know that I am Yahweh, when I've made the land a desolate waste because of all the detestable things that they've done. So anyone else who was left would be killed off by the sword or by animals or by the plague, and the whole land would be empty. Nothing else would be there. Okay? But you know, if we look at what happened to the northern nation of Israel when the Assyrians came in, they took the people out of Assyria, but then they brought other people in. So were the Babylonians, would they do the same sort of thing? Well, 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 21 says, "The land enjoyed its Sabbath rest. All the time of its desolation it rested until the 70 years were completed in fulfillment of the word of Yahweh spoken by Jeremiah." So no, the Babylonians did not repopulate it. They left it vacant, and it stayed vacant, and the land enjoyed 70 years of Sabbath rest. So 70 years of nobody living there, nobody doing anything there. Okay? Now, Nebuchadnezzar would know that there would be some people left, that this is his territory now. He owns this land, and someone's got to kind of be in charge. So he appoints a governor. And we see that in 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 22. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, appointed Gedaliah, a son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, to be over the people he had left behind in Judah. So a guy named Gedaliah. Now, this it mentions his name Ahikam. If you look back at 2 Kings chapter 22, you see that Ahikam was one of the guys who worked very closely with King Josiah to enact reforms and return the people to faith in God, to faith in Yahweh. So Nebuchadnezzar, again, trying to please the God of the land, takes Gedaliah and puts him in charge as governor. Okay. Now we also see that Jeremiah gets to stay behind. How is that? Turn to Jeremiah chapter 40. "The word came to Jeremiah from the Lord under Nebuzaradan." Okay, Nebuchadnezzar had a commander named Nebuzaradan, so you get these things confused here. "He was commander of the imperial guard that had released him at Ramah. He found Jeremiah bound in chains among all the captives from Jerusalem and Judah who were being carried into exile to Babylon. When the commander of the guard found Jeremiah, he said to him, 'Yahweh your God decreed this disaster for this place. And now, Yahweh has brought it about. He's done just as he said he would.'" Okay, so the Babylonians recognize Yahweh's hands here. "All this has happened because the people sinned against Yahweh and did not obey him." So they're recognizing God's hand in this. "But today I am freeing you from the chains on your wrists. Come with me to Babylon if you like." And this again is Nebuzaradan talking to Jeremiah. So he's freeing Jeremiah. "You can come to Babylon with me if you like, and I'll look after you. But if you don't want to, then don't come. Look, the whole country lies before you. Go wherever you please." So Jeremiah was one of the captives in this second deportation, and he was recognized and released. In fact, what Nebuzaradan was doing, he wasn't doing it on his own accord. If you look at the prior chapter, in verse 11 to 14, it says that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had given these orders about Jeremiah through Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard. "Take him and look after him. Don't harm him, but do for him whatever he asks." So Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guard, Nebushaban, a chief officer, Nergal-Sharezer, a high official, and all the other officers of the king of Babylon sent and had Jeremiah taken out of the courtyard of the guard. They turned him over to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, to take him back to his home. So he remained among his own people. So Nebuchadnezzar stood up and protected Jeremiah because he saw that Jeremiah was a prophet of the God of the land, and he released him. So Jeremiah went back with Gedaliah. Now, what about other people? There, again, people who had hidden would die by the sword, animals or plague, God had said, but there, not only would they be hiding in the ruins or in caves, but maybe have run away when this whole attack happened and ran away to other countries. So what about these people? Chapter 40, verse 11. "When all the Jews in Moab, Ammon, Edom, and all the other countries heard that the king of Babylon had left a remnant in Judah and appointed Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, as governor over them, they all came back to the land of Judah to Gedaliah at Mizpah from all the countries where they had been scattered, and they harvested an abundance of wine and summer fruit." So anyone who had run away came back. Okay, they had heard that things were okay, that Nebuchadnezzar was leaving and leaving Gedaliah there, and Gedaliah had a good name, and so they all came back and returned to Judah to farm under Gedaliah. Well, what happened to Gedaliah? Going on. Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the army officers still in the open country came to Gedaliah at Mizpah and said to him, "Don't you know that Baalis, the king of the Ammonites, has sent Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, to take your life?" But Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, did not believe them. So he was warned of an assassination plan, but he didn't believe him. So going on, chapter 41, verse 2, Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, and the 10 men who were with him got up and struck down Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, with the sword, killing the one whom the king of Babylon had appointed as governor over the land. Ishmael also killed all the Jews who were with Gedaliah at Mizpah, as well as the Babylonian soldiers who were there. So this guy who was hired or instructed by the king of Moab, or the king of the Ammonites, he goes and he killed Gedaliah. And not only Gedaliah, but the other people, the other officials, the other leaders that were there with Gedaliah, and the Babylonian soldiers were there. So here he's, this is a big deal. He's attacking Babylonian soldiers. Well, what does that mean for the rest of the people who are there? What do they do? Chapter 42. Then all the army officers, including Johanan, the son of Kareah, and Jezaniah, the son of Hoshaiah, and all the people from the least to the greatest approached Jeremiah the prophet and said to him, "Please, hear our petition and pray to Yahweh your God for this entire remnant. For as you see, though we were once many, now only a few are left. Pray that Yahweh your God will tell us where we should go and what we should do. We've got to do something. Where are we supposed to go? We can't stay here. Where should we go?" So Jeremiah asked God what we should do. And they go on and say that we will do exactly what you tell us. Whether verse 6, whether it's favorable or unfavorable, we'll obey Yahweh our God to whom we're sending you so that it'll be well with us. We will obey Yahweh our God. Okay? So they tell him that, to go pray. So what answer does Jeremiah return with? I'll start at verse 9. He said to them, "This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, to whom you sent me to present your petition, says. If you stay in this land, I will build you up and not tear you down. I will plant you and not uproot you, for I am grieved over the disaster that I've inflicted on you. Do not be afraid of the king of Babylon, whom you now fear. Don't be afraid of him, declares the Lord, for I am with you, and I will save you and deliver you from his hands. I will show you compassion so that he will have compassion on you and restore you to your land. However, if you say, 'We will not stay in this land,' and so disobey Yahweh your God, and if you say, 'No, we're going to go and live in Egypt, where we will not see war or hear the trumpet or be hungry for bread,'" because Egypt's a long ways away from Babylon, okay, so that's where they feel they could possibly hide. "Well, then hear the word of the Lord, O remnant of Judah. This is what the Lord Almighty says. If you are determined to go to Egypt and you go down and settle there, then the sword that you fear will overtake you there, and the famine that you dread will follow you into Egypt, and there you will die." Okay? All who are determined to go to Egypt to settle there will die by the sword, famine, and plague. Not one of them will survive or escape the disaster that I will bring upon them, God says. So God says, okay, here's your moment of testing. You want to know what to do? Stay here. If you stay here, I will bless you. I will protect you. I will take care of you. But if you don't trust me, if you're afraid of the king of the Babylonians and you run away and you go to Egypt, then the very thing that you're afraid of will follow you to Egypt and you will die there. So, very clear. They said, we're going to obey you. Whatever God says, God's made it very clear. So that's what they do, right? They stay there. Chapter 43, verse 2. Azariah the son of Hoshaiah and Johanan the son of Kareah and all the arrogant men said to Jeremiah, "You're lying. The Lord our God did not send you here to say you must not go to Egypt to settle there. But Baruch, your sidekick, the son of Neriah, is inciting you against us to hand us over to the Babylonians so that they may kill us or carry us into exile into Babylon." Okay, they're blaming him of lie, calling him a liar. Baruch is telling you to say this, not God. Instead, Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the army officers led away all the remnant of Judah who had come back to live in the land of Judah from all the nations where they had been scattered. They also led away all the men, the women and children, and the king's daughters whom Nebuzaradan, the commander of the imperial guard, had left with Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, and they also took Jeremiah the prophet and Baruch, the son of Neriah. So they entered Egypt in disobedience to the Lord and went as far as Tapanhes, which is a long ways away. So they disobeyed God's word. They fled to Egypt and they said, we're going to make sure everyone goes with us. And they rounded up everybody that was there, everybody who had returned. And so now you get this third exile, this third departure, so that nobody, really nobody is left. Okay? Even Jeremiah, they take him with them. Okay? Okay? You got to come with us, Jeremiah, and you'll protect us here, right? Well, how would God punish this disobedience? Chapter 44, verse 13. I will punish those who live in Egypt with the sword, famine, and plague, just as I had punished Jerusalem. None of the remnant of Judah who have gone to live in Egypt will escape or survive to return to the land of Judah, to which they long to return and live. None will return, except maybe a few fugitives. So God would kill all of those who had rejected him by disobeying the word that he had given through Jeremiah to stay in the land and not go to Egypt. And then they went to Egypt. And so God would punish them. They would all die by the sword, plague, or famine, just as he had said would happen. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you give us. We see ourselves so many times in the rejections that these people have given you, that you give them warnings, you call them to return to you, but yet they continue to reject you. And there's so many times you do that with us, that you call us back to you. And so many times we're too busy, or we're focused on this or focused on that, and we don't come back to you as you have asked us to. Forgive us for that. Continue to pour out your mercy and grace on us that we don't deserve, but because of what your Son, Jesus Christ, did for us, that you offer to bring us back to you, even though we don't deserve that. Thank you for the lessons of Jeremiah, who remained faithful, of Ezekiel, who taught us what your will really is, rather than trying to see that all hope is lost. But you're always there calling us back. We can never go too far away from you that you won't welcome us back. We thank and praise you for that. In the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, who brings us back to you. Amen.